We know in migraine that the areas involved with light and smell are particularly overactive most of the time. And again, the more often you have attacks, the more these areas are lit up. So it makes a lot of sense that for people with migraine, not only can you have allodynia, but you can have a heightened sense of smell, a heightened sense of hearing. So you can like hear that ambulance two blocks down that no one else can hear. You can smell everyone's lunch in the office. And, you know, you can see the lights that are brighter than everyone else. Like even on a cloudy day, you're wearing sunglasses and everyone else is like, whoa, it's dark. What do you mean? But everything is heightened for our patients with migraine. And that's because the brain is just a little bit more sensitive and aware. And we have a lot of data now that supports that all of these areas are lit up in our patients with migraine, even between migraine attacks.
Living in chronic pain is draining, physically, emotionally, and financially. So many aspects of our life become completely dictated based on our pain levels. We try to seek care only to be dismissed and discounted by certain physicians. We get taken advantage of by marketers preying upon our desperation. We just want answers, yet it's so difficult to know who we can really trust and what will really help. To provide her perspective on living with chronic pain conditions like allodynia, fibromyalgia, and migraine is Dr. Jessica Ilani. Dr. Ilani, welcome back to the Migraine World Summit.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for having me back.
So happy to have you. So, what is allodynia?
Yeah, so let's get into it. We're going to start with the difficult stuff. I love it. So allodynia, it's a very big word, but it's actually a very simple definition. That's when normal touch, like touching your hair, or your scalp, or even just putting on a t-shirt is painful when it's not supposed to be. Allodynia can be caused by disruption in the way the nervous system is working and the way the nerves on the outside of your body are communicating back to the brain. And they're just sending the signals in such a way that the brain is getting overactive. And now it's just thinking everything that's normal touch is painful when it's not supposed to be.
Interesting. So is that something like, you know, when you get a sunburn and your t-shirt hurts just touching you?
So that's actually hyperalgesia. It's a very good correlation. You're trying to make sense of this because hyperalgesia is when you actually did something to cause injury, like a burn, like a sunburn, and there's actually something wrong. And so that touch is painful. That's your body's way of saying, don't touch that. It's hurt. It's injured. Allodynia is a little different because you didn't actually burn your skin, but your skin thinks you burned your skin, right? It's like a big trick. And it's very evil in some ways because there's no actual burn there. And your body's telling you there's like a burn there. And often I tell my migraine patients, you know, it helps us to understand this process of, you know, people will always say, well, why am I having a migraine? I don't understand. It's as if your body thinks there's a knife there. There's a big knife in my head. There's no knife there. You can't see the knife, but you sure do feel it. And it's kind of that process, as if there's a knife in the head, someone took the knife away, but the body still thinks there's a knife there when there isn't. And now it's activated this whole system and you have this ongoing sense of pain when there shouldn't be pain.
The knife makes perfect sense based on my own migraine experience.
Yeah.
How common is allodynia in migraine patients?
It can be rather common, especially in our women patients with migraine, those that have migraine with aura, when you can see like visual flashing lights before your migraine, or sometimes you have speech disruption before your migraine. We also see it more commonly in patients who have frequent migraine attacks, like chronic migraine, when you're having half the month of headaches, with at least eight of those being migraine in nature. These are times that allodynia can become more often. And we think that has to do with the fact that you never really have too much break between that next attack. And so the brain really doesn't get that time to rest up and get back to its normal functional state. So it's always hyperactive and it's in a state of central sensitization. Lots of big words again, but just think of as if all of this inflammation, irritation is always ongoing and it never gets to calm down. It's like a whole bunch of very noisy kids having a party all the time and nobody's telling them to go to bed. That's what's happening in the brain. So the more often this happens, the harder it is for it to quiet down and reset. And that's why we can see it often in patients with migraine.
Interesting. So can it exist as an interictal symptom, or is it only during attacks?
So as I said, in patients that have chronic migraine, allodynia can definitely exist in between attacks where there's always this sense of sensitivity. So just they feel like even putting a hat on or pulling their hair in a ponytail is just a no-no, like not something they can do. Brushing their hair is difficult, taking a shower sometimes, and washing their hair can be tough. In people who have episodes of migraine, and this is more typical, most people with migraine have 2 to 4 migraine attacks per month. Allodynia really dissipates in between migraine attacks. So for the majority of patients with migraine, they don't have allodynia in between attacks itself.
How does migraine cause allodynia?
This is a more complicated issue. So what happens in migraine is you have activation of one of the peripheral nerves, one of the nerves on the outside of the body. This is called the fifth nerve or the trigeminal nerve. This nerve gets activated when the blood vessels that are on the outside of the brain get bigger and they release all of these chemicals. These chemicals activate this nerve. The nerve goes back and communicates to the brain and says, "Hey, brain, big problem. Shut everything down because we've got this big issue going on. We've got to recruit all of the helpers, and we've got to shut this process down." And so that's really how the migraine process starts. If we don't shut this process down within an hour or two, that dilation of blood vessels and all the recruitment of these angry friends, they've really stopped. But the brain doesn't think they stop. They think there's still this emergency going on. So now they're recruiting, and everything's angry and oversensitive inside the brain because nobody shut this process down. So there's this constant ongoing noise. And then the nerve starts to get really mad, saying, "Hey, the brain's angry, so I'm going to be angry." Now they're pinging off of each other. You have what's called central sensitization and peripheral sensitization. The longer these two go, the harder it gets to treat a migraine attack. And we have evidence that suggests sometimes the more often these attacks will occur, the more often they occur, and the more likely you are into getting into chronic migraine. So this is sometimes why a lot of times we tell our patients, you know, if you're having a migraine and they're infrequent, don't ignore the migraine, treat it early, because we want to avoid it becoming this process where you get central sensitization, peripheral sensitization, and now you're having more frequent migraines that are harder to treat, and everything is on fire, and we don't have the right tools to really shut this process down.
Is the area that is activated by the brain for the sensitivity to touch that we experience, is that anywhere close to the areas of the brain responding to sensitivity to like scent or hearing or sight? Are they related?
They can be very close together. So when you have central sensitization, actually the entire brain can get overactive, but we know in migraine that the areas involved with light and smell are particularly overactive most of the time. And again, the more often you have attacks, the more these areas are lit up. So it makes a lot of sense that for people with migraine, not only can you have allodynia, but you can have a heightened sense of smell, a heightened sense of hearing. So you can like hear that ambulance 2 blocks down that no one else can hear. You can smell everyone's lunch in the office. And, you know, you can see the lights that are brighter than everyone else. Like even on a cloudy day, you're wearing sunglasses and everyone else is like, "Whoa, it's dark. What do you mean?" But everything is heightened for our patients with migraine. And that's because the brain is just a little bit more sensitive and aware. And we have a lot of data now that supports that all of these areas are lit up in our patients with migraine, even between migraine attacks.
Wow. How do people get stuck into a chronic pain cycle?
Yeah, these pain cycles can be very difficult because, as I mentioned, you know, the more frequent you get pain, the more frequent pain can cause itself. And so we have studies that show us that patients that have attacks that are frequent can start to have these processes in the brain where the brain is more sensitive and it's easier to get that next attack because the brain's ready. It says, "Oh, yep, there's always that knife laying around, even though it's not there. I'm ready to, you know, shout at the nerve. The nerve's angry at me. We're going to have fights all the time. I'm going to constantly have pain." There's studies that show us that people that don't have a good treatment for when they have an attack, so the attack lasts longer and is more frequent and not well treated, are more likely to end up in this chronic pain cycle or chronic migraine when it comes to migraine. We have data that suggests that being female is more likely to make you prone to having chronic pain, chronic migraine in general. And we think that has to do with shifts in estrogen level and shifts in testosterone level, that perhaps higher testosterone in men protects them to some degree from chronic pain conditions compared to estrogen levels, where we have higher estrogen levels in women. And that maybe might make us more prone to certain pain conditions and also makes us genetically more predisposed to some of these issues.
So what do we do to break this? Do we have any hope of getting out of chronic migraine?
I think it can be in different ways. Well, one, if you're just starting into that chronicity, you know, you're going from someone who has episodes of migraine to all of a sudden you get into what we call status migrainosis. You go from having a couple of episodes every once in a while to having a headache every day. It's important to get in touch with your healthcare provider because there's some things that can be done to really break up that cycle and not keep it going continuously. And these can be, you know, medication options, injections, going to get infusions of intravenous medications like dihydroergotamine, which can really break up that migraine cycle. On the other hand, if you've been having, you know, chronic daily pain for over 20 years, it's going to be a more comprehensive, extensive approach that might take longer to really reset that system. But it's not a hopeless situation. It just might be resetting the goals and really thinking about how do I make myself more functional? How do I have goals that are more achievable? Like, I want to make it to a major family event. I want to get back into the workplace again and have more achievable goals as opposed to working 90 hours a week, not sleeping at all, and not taking care of myself. I honestly don't think that's healthy for any of us. And sometimes you take a look at someone who has chronic migraine and the lifestyle they were living before and the lifestyle they have after. It's a much healthier, much more balanced, much more centered lifestyle.
Definitely. And when every moment of your life is controlled by this pain, I personally can say I'm willing to do a ton of work and it's obviously required. Would you have any like top favorites? So if, you know, I came to you and was like, please just give me some semblance of a life. Are there any of those very like minor changes that would really help the most?
I will often tell my patients to focus a bit on sleep. I mean, I think sleep habits are a big problem for everybody. I don't think any of us gets good sleep, but it is essential when our patients are sleeping well and they get good quality of sleep. And they really, it's not rely on medication, good quality sleep. It's look at your sleep environment. Make sure you go to bed and wake the same time, that the bedroom is comfortable, that you're not overheated or too cold. You don't have screens in the room. This is not where you watch TV at night. You know, if you're sitting in bed and you can't fall asleep, you get up after 15 minutes, you take a walk out and you come back. That I tell all of my patients who have children, like we have children have bedtime routines. Adults need bedtime routines as well. And I think we forget this. And a lot of times I'll tell my patients to listen to mindful meditation at bedtime, guided meditation, taking deep breaths, sleep stories on certain apps. They're very, very helpful. But to build this regimen in the evening to really allow yourself to de-stress from whatever your day was like. And in the same way, your wake-up routine is essential as well. And I think that's a good time to practice a little bit of stretches, neck, shoulder, back, hips, especially as, I mean, we get into our 40s, everything starts to creak. And I think it's really important we take a few moments in the morning and we remind ourselves, this is where my body is. This is how it feels today. It's important to do these stretches. You know, I think that those regimens are important, trying to do that mind-body connection when you can, and not to obsess so much on, this is where my pain level is right now. This is where my pain level is right now. That can be a very unhealthy, and it can lead you down a very like a negative path, you know, sometimes obsessing about I'm a level 8 right now, I'm a level 4 right now, I'm a level 3 right now. I think that it's more about, I feel good. I think I can take a walk right now, or, you know, I'm tired. I'm going to sit down and I'm going to listen to a book right now. And I think finding the activities in the day that make you happy and ensuring that you try to enrich your day with at least one or two of these activities, especially if you're working full-time and living with chronic pain. I think this is when people are the most taxed. They're working full-time, they're parenting, they're commuting long distances, they're getting back into the workplace now.
All right, walk me through the difference between nociceptive and neuropathic pain.
So nociceptive pain is the most common type of pain. It's whenever something is harming our body, it's our body's sense of saying, oh, something is hurting me, so I'm going to cause pain to warn my brain that there's something hurting me. So if I cut my finger, I'm going to have pain that's like a cut type feeling, like when you cut yourself. Or if someone steps on my foot, I'll get that like pressure pain that comes from someone stepping on my foot. Or if I put my hand on a hot pan, you know, you pull away because you get the heat sensation. So it's the different types of pain you feel when you're getting an injury to your body. And it's, again, the most common type of pain. Neuropathic pain comes from injury of a nerve, and it's very particular. So say I cut my finger again, but I cut so deep that it slashed the nerve. You'll get like not an immediate pain, but it will leave you with this like deep throbbing pain that turns into like a shooting electrical pain that sometimes becomes burning pain over time. And then you can have numbness over the area of the nerve. And sometimes as the nerve grows back, it can give you very abnormal pain. So a burning, tingling, numbness type, creepy, crawly pain. This is usually what patients will describe to us when we see them in clinic. And this is just the nerve is damaged and now it's shooting off abnormal signals back to the brain saying, oh, I'm not, you know, something's not right. Something's not right. It's not as common. We can see it again, anytime there's a physical injury to the nerve itself, or there's some kind of damage that caused it.
Fibromyalgia is a chronic condition characterized by widespread pain, fatigue, and other symptoms such as sleep and mood disorders. Whereas allodynia is a different type of pain and a symptom of migraine. However, there's a lot of similarities. So for example, people with fibromyalgia report frustration that with, like migraine, there's no blood test or x-ray to confirm the diagnosis. So there's a lot of stigma there. How do you respond to patients who feel stigmatized by this?
I think it's really easy to feel very alone whenever you have a chronic pain condition, because pain isn't always easy to see on the body, like some other medical conditions. And so I will often talk to my patients whenever they're having migraine and they feel like they're very alone, to remind them that they're not alone, that this is a disease that's very common, occurring in over 40 million people in the United States. And they're part of a very large community. I find that my patients sometimes want to partake in conversations with this community, and then it's a great idea to introduce them to different types of chat boards or community organizations where they can talk to other people who have a similar disease process. I think that it's also really important to talk to people a little bit about what messages they're hearing in their own social community. I think that I'm always shocked as a provider that I will hear sometimes that they have family or friends that don't believe they have a real disease. And oftentimes in those cases, I will try to see if I can send information home for that family member or have that family member engage in visits with us. Sometimes that's helpful, sometimes it's not. But I think that is often a huge point of frustration for the patient, is when they have someone they care about that doesn't support them or support that the disease is real. I do think that there's been many campaigns, at least within the migraine space, also in the fibromyalgia space, that's really making it a lot more well known. And I think with that, we're starting to see a lot of family members accepting that this is a real disease, not just a headache. This is a migraine, and you have migraine-specific treatment options. And people who didn't really necessarily believe their family members before are now sending their family members back into clinic with a list of particular medicines they want them to discuss with me. And so sometimes we do what we can, but I hate to say advertising and marketing is sometimes very helpful as well. And this comes up quite frequently in migraine when it comes to advocating for their healthcare and for their treatment options, which a lot of times I think patients think that if I write a treatment as a physician, that treatment should be approved. And then if I ask the insurance company, they'll just listen to me. And I think a lot of times the patients are really surprised when I tell them, actually, you're the purchaser of the insurance along with the company, whoever you're employed by or whoever it comes from. And a lot of times it's teaching them how to advocate and have a voice to get their treatment covered. And sometimes that piece of power, once it works, can really be very meaningful for the patient to kind of fight their battle and make their voice heard.
All right. So in people with migraine, 30% of them also have fibromyalgia. In people with fibromyalgia, about 55% of them also have migraine. So, but people with fibromyalgia aren't treated by neurologists. Who would you recommend your patients also see?
So many of my patients who do have migraine also have fibromyalgia, as you mentioned. And oftentimes I will refer my patients either to start with their primary care provider, or if they're not really finding success there, to see a rheumatologist who specializes in fibromyalgia. This really is the specialty that seems to manage fibromyalgia the best.
And when we have so many different doctors, how do we ensure that we're doing everything we can to make sure that they're coordinating care? What is the patient's role and what are the doctor's role?
So I think a lot of this does fall to the patient. And I think that's because of the way our medical system is working today, especially if you're seeing just specialists and it's not looping through a primary care provider. I know that patients often get frustrated about this. And I think that's because people can be very used to everything coming through like a home base of a primary. But when you're seeing all specialists, you know, we're not the home base. We never really will be. We're usually just the specialist who just do our own thing. So I think the most important thing for the patient is make sure you collect the notes from the visits from the doctors you've seen. Nowadays, with our electronic medical record, all of us have portals and the notes are available on the portals. So it's very easy for you to pull up the notes and the summaries of the visits at any time. So make sure you sign up for these portals and have your notes printed out if you're going to see multiple specialists, so they can see, okay, this is what's being done by the other physicians. It's really nice when it's all organized and the patient brings it in. If I ask, oh, have you had this done? And they're like, yep, here you go. You can make a copy of this and then I'll keep it with me, because then it saves you time from getting duplicate tests. It saves you time from saying, oh, I don't know, I'll look for it later. All the answers are there. It makes it so much faster for us to make the diagnosis. Another mistake is oftentimes patients will think that because we're an electronic medical record, they all communicate with each other, which really, I wish they would, but they don't. In fact, if I'm in one healthcare system and someone's in another healthcare system, they don't talk to each other because they're just not made that way. It's ridiculous. And so a lot of times I'll have patients think I can see their provider's notes, so they don't bring them, but the provider's in another healthcare system. I do have other patients though who purposely set up all of their appointments within the same healthcare system, which honestly is amazing because then I can see every single note from every single provider, all the tests done, all the labs done. But that's not always possible, especially if you're coming from a distance. You don't really want to drive 2 hours to see your primary care provider. That just really makes no sense. So I think the best way to be prepared is just keep that folder of your information and just be prepared to be the communication point between your providers and use the portal and use that electronic medical record system. It's not so hard and it's annoying. I won't say it's not. You have to remember 100 different passwords, but it can really save you a ton of time and energy and frustration.
How does having fibromyalgia in addition to migraine affect the patient?
I think anytime you have multiple pain conditions, it is very difficult. You're living not only with one chronic pain condition, but two, sometimes three or four. And now your disability level starts to increase. Another thing that I've noticed in clinical practice is that sometimes we get one chronic pain condition under control only to have another start to act up. I'll have patients who have chronic migraine and fibromyalgia, and we get the chronic migraine under control, and then their fibromyalgia starts to act up. And you feel terrible as a provider because you're like, we just got this one major issue under control, and now this poor patient's so disabled because of another major issue. And sometimes they'll play well together. We get one under control, the other's controlled, and everything's wonderful. But more often than not, I find that they don't always correlate with each other. But if one acts up, the other one doesn't change. If the other one acts up, migraine doesn't change. And so there's not a complete correlation between one activating and the other not.
Are there any medications that that treat both migraine and fibromyalgia at the same time that we can get the two-for-one effect?
Two-for-one, yeah. So generally, we have been trying to move away from the two-for-one effect because we find that it is better for us to use best evidence medicine for one disease over another. I say this, but I'll tell you, it's very hard when you're sitting in front of someone and you know they have three or four disorders and to not just be like, I think I have one drug that might treat all of this, even though that one drug isn't the best evidence for all of these. And this is really where fibromyalgia and migraine are interesting. So for fibromyalgia, at least the older evidence, we have tricyclic antidepressants and SNRIs, so the serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, that have shown to be effective in modulating frequency and severity of fibromyalgia. We know these same medications have shown efficacy for treatment of prevention of migraine. Their level of evidence for migraine isn't as high, especially as we have some newer medications and treatments in migraine. But if you do have a patient with fibromyalgia, I think more often than not, we will probably try to pull from one of these medications, either as a standalone treatment or as an additional medication to try to co-treat both disorders before handing the patient off to another specialist.
So going off that, we know that if we take migraine medication really early in the attack, it's way more effective. However, when you're having so many attacks and you're so worried about medication overuse, you end up feeling so guilty and scared to take this pain medication. And that definitely occurs in other pain conditions, such as fibromyalgia. Do you have any advice for patients like that who are just feeling so guilty and so scared about, like, when do I take it? When do I not take it? What do I do?
Yeah, I think it's really a difficult situation when guilt starts to play a role. I think that people with chronic pain already feel a sense of guilt that they're letting their family and their friends down, that have patients who don't work anymore, and they feel like they're letting society down. And then you're carrying that guilt on your shoulders, then you're having chronic pain and you don't know how to treat it so you can kind of move forward. So the first thing is you have to unpack some of that guilt and deal with, how are you going to reprocess that? And that in itself is extremely important, because if you don't process that guilt, you know, that guilt can turn into depression very quickly. And that's not going to make the process of healing any easier. The second part of that is that patients who have frequent pain should not only have one way to treat the pain. You can't just rely on medications all the time. There's going to have to be some form of neuromodulation, which is using a device to treat the pain when the pain is mild to moderate. You're going to have medications. You should have a medication that's maybe very powerful, like a triptan or DHE, that you can use on occasion, but not all the time. You're going to have some medications more that you can pull when the pain is moderate, like an NSAID, Gepant, that maybe can be used a little bit more frequently and are not likely to cause medication overuse headache like the Gepants. You are going to have to do relaxation, deep breathing, mindful-based stress reduction, biofeedback, acupuncture. And this is when we're starting to layer numerous therapies for acute treatment of migraine. So you're really having a toolbox. I tell my patients, you cannot treat every day with pain with medication. It is a horrible thing to have to tell someone, but you should be able to manage the pain every day with some form of treatment. And what that is might vary day to day, depending on how you're feeling. This goes back to my start the day with the stretch and the day with the mindful relaxation. It's really building this continuous toolbox of, like, how am I feeling? What am I going to layer in right now to try to get me to the next step? I say this all easily. I am very honest. None of what I'm saying is easy to do. It is not easy to prescribe this. It can be very costly. It can be very time intensive. But when it's done appropriately and you can really stick with it, which can be very difficult, it can kind of lead you to a place where you can live with chronic pain a little bit more manageably. Now, that does not mean that everybody with chronic migraine or chronic pain will always have chronic migraine or chronic pain. It just means that while you're in that process, you know, it's just working through that process until you're in kind of that next stage where things are a bit better.
I love that message. On that note, is there a way that we can follow your work? Do you have any closing remarks?
So my closing remarks are that, you know, chronic pain is a very difficult thing to deal with. The brain just goes a little bit nuts, and it can be very hard to understand when you're talking to other people that it's not a visible thing, but that there really is a party going on that you want nothing to do with. So I tell my patients, you know, if it's hard for other people to understand, there's a host of different websites that can be really easy to bring them to understand. There's the American Migraine Foundation, there's the National Headache Foundation, and then there's scores of patient-friendly websites out there that really can bring that message home so that you don't feel alone or stigmatized by your disease. I don't have any big social media outlets. I'm a pretty homely kind of person, but you can always catch me on the American Headache Society website or some meeting where I speak at or I'm very involved, and always at programs like this, because I really do enjoy spreading that message to patients and to other healthcare providers about migraine so that people really aren't afraid to treat this disease. And there's a lot more people like myself who can reach out and take care of people with migraine out there, because headache specialists are too few and far between.
There is nothing better than getting to talk to a doctor who truly understands both the physical and emotional aspects of living with chronic pain. And it was such an honor to talk to you today. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Harlani.
Thank you so much for having me.